You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. We don't fight like that around here. Martial arts taboos, cowardly fighting, and other oxymorons. You might think that the pursuit of training in the martial arts for the purpose of self-defense would always be guided by logic and practicality. And indeed, logic and practicality are great drivers in formulating the technical body of martial arts knowledge. Less useful, but perhaps equally influential in shaping different martial arts styles from different cultures, are cultural mores and taboos. In other words, cultural rules that lay out what type of fighting is acceptable and what type of fighting is dirty, barbaric, cowardly, and thus unacceptable. There is a parallel phenomenon with scientific discoveries. Often, new knowledge must batter its way past cultural taboos before it becomes accepted. When Galileo, and later Copernicus, put forth the proposition that the sun was at the center of the solar system and not the earth, the church, which was hugely influential, railed against the hypothesis, and as a result, Galileo was forced to publicly recant the heliocentric model, and then spent the rest of his life under house arrest. He was fortunate not to be burned at the stake, like his fellow Italian cosmologist, Giordano Bruno, who went a step further and claimed that the stars were distant suns. In the same fashion, when new martial techniques and concepts emerge in a culture, they may or may not pass the smell test of the indigenous cultural taboos. When chimpanzees fight one another, one of their most commonly used tactics is biting. They seek to bite off their opponent's fingers, genitals, or a chunk of flesh, often from the face. Before you recoil in indignant horror at this, you should understand that chimpanzees are humanity's closest relatives, and it's almost certain that if you go back far enough in time, our ancestors fought like this as well. It's not much of a stretch to imagine a cultural taboo developing in which one or more of our ancestral hunter-gatherer tribes decided that biting in a fight was cowardly or barbaric, and thus discouraged its use. Extremely primitive forms of warfare probably consisted of not much more than clusters of individuals in single combat, or two or three on one, without much use of formations or plans. I can imagine that as some human cultures began to use infantry formations in battle, members of enemy cultures may have derided them for using a cowardly fighting style. Imagine each man protecting his flanks with the body or shield of his adjacent comrade. Scandalous. Horses began to be used in warfare even before they were bred to a size large enough for men to ride them. Instead, they drew chariots, which were a bit like the first tanks. Chariots could storm in faster than a man could run, in a cloud of dust. One man drove while the other wielded a war bow, spitting deadly arrows in every direction. Then the chariot would dash away before infantry could close with them. It's not much of a reach to imagine that at least some of their opponents derided these methods as cowardly, using dumb animals and the technology of the bow to kill men from a distance, when any real man would stand up to you in single combat. Moving forward in time, it's a common trope to describe the tactics of British troops during the American Revolution as foolish. Every woman's dream date, Bill Cosby, even did a comedy bit about this particular subject. From our modern perspective, it seems silly to wear brightly colored uniforms and bunch together on the battlefield in tight formation like so many targets. But such an attitude betrays ignorance of military technology at that time. The standard military firearm of this time was the musket. It had a smooth bore with no rifling. It was capable of firing a massive 75 caliber ball, but only to an effective range of 50 to 100 yards, before flying wildly off course. It's difficult to use such a weapon to stop a determined man who wants to spear you with his bayonet from charging close enough to do it. One man hiding behind cover was not dangerous with a musket, unless you got very close. The solution was to have your infantry unit stand in close formation and fire their muskets simultaneously at an enemy formation. This effectively turned a unit of individuals into a giant shotgun. That's much more effective than hiding and sniping with a single inaccurate weapon. The gunpowder used at this time was not yet the smokeless powder of more than a century later, so each mass volley fired produced huge clouds of dense smoke. This made visibility extremely poor on large sections of the battlefield. One solution for a commander who was observing and directing his troops was to dress them in brightly colored uniforms, thus making it easier to see their movements from his command position, and to distinguish them from the differently colored uniforms of the enemy. So you see, wearing brightly colored uniforms and standing in closely packed formations was actually practical for the technology of the time. But I'm certain that as the technology changed and the rifled musket came into use, allowing for the possibility of new and looser formations, there were still people who considered the old way of fighting to be the more, quote, civilized, unquote, and manly way. Such emotional reactions are common in the face of changes in military technology. I could cite countless other examples of this phenomenon throughout the course of military history. In a similar vein, standards of what is allowed and not allowed in individual fighting also falls prey to the restrictions of cultural taboos as well. There are three types of individual combat to consider. First is sport competition. Second is self-defense. Third is what I will refer to as street dueling. What I mean by street dueling is fighting outside of sport, but for reasons other than defending yourself or your loved ones. Specifically, fighting to defend what you perceive to be your honor or reputation, or if you're a really sick puppy because you enjoy fighting. This type of fighting has led to more cultural restrictions than any other kind, many of them referring to the concept of, quote, fairness, unquote, whatever that word means in a world which produces humans of such varying sizes and talent levels. If you're truly fighting for self-defense, fairness is not a consideration. In the realm of martial sport, in the early days of boxing, the use of defense, especially evasion, of your opponent's blows, was considered by many to be unmanly and even cowardly. The man who took the heavyweight world boxing championship away from John L. Sullivan in 1892 was named James Corbett, nicknamed Gentleman Jim. Corbett revolutionized boxing, raising footwork and the use of the jab to a new level. He had a horde of fans, but just as with Muhammad Ali almost a century later, and Sugar Ray Leonard a bit after that, there were a great many haters as well who felt that the emphasis these fighters placed on footwork and defense betrayed cowardice. I've spoken before about fans like this. These are the type of folks who create the demand for sports like tough man contests and even Russian face slapping, where each combatant takes turns standing or sitting completely still and allowing his opponent to slap his face as hard as possible until one combatant gives up. Now that's manly. From the time I began teaching the martial arts in 1975, I encouraged my students to practice and perfect kicking techniques aimed at targets below the opponent's waist, as well as above, even when sparring. It was my feeling that if you can use control to not injure your opponent's ribs, brain, or neck with a kick, you could use control to not injure their legs as well. At that time, nearly all commercial martial arts academies forbade kicking below the waist when sparring because it was, quote, too dangerous, unquote, as if kicking above the waist is not dangerous. There was also the implication that kicking low was dirty. If you are younger than 30, you may not realize that at that time almost no one was training for a low-kicking game. My academy developed an undeserved reputation with practitioners from other schools in the area as being a den of crazy, dirty fighters, solely based on the fact that we were practicing low kicking. We had become, in effect, the Cobra Kai of my geographical area. It wasn't until the modern era of MMA that this prejudice began to be undermined, though it still exists in many places. Few martial cultures have contributed as much to modern practical fighting as has that of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. But even BJJ has suffered from cultural taboos, specifically regarding employing leg locking as part of the grappling arsenal. Many practitioners of BJJ regard the use of leg locks as unsophisticated and barbaric. This taboo is not so prevalent as it once was, but there was a time when even attempting one of the few legal leg locks in competition was likely to draw the ire of at least a large part of the crowd. Moving on to self-defense and street dueling, when I was in elementary school back in the 60s, it was common knowledge on the playground that if you used kicking in a fight, you were fighting like a girl. Nothing more needed to be said. In many parts of Latin America, any form of grappling on the ground apparently violates the code of machismo, and anyone who voluntarily does so will find his sexual orientation to be suspect. As I mentioned earlier, street dueling has far more cultural restrictions than true self-defense. One of them is, never kick a man while he's down. First of all, unless you live in prison or in a ghetto, street dueling is nearly always foolish, wasteful, and possibly criminal. You should only fight to defend yourself or your loved ones. If I'm fighting for the right reason, and my opponent is much bigger than me, and I'm fortunate enough to knock him down or take him down, I have absolutely no problem with using kicks to make sure he stays down, so long as I feel in danger, or until I'm able to safely escape the situation. The ethical line is crossed in self-defense when you go beyond defending yourself and move into the realm of punishing your opponent. You have no right to punish your opponent. You have every right to defend yourself. A similar case could be made for a man fighting a woman. If the fighting is being done for the right reason, self-defense, I see no problem here either. I can envision many scenarios in which a small man or teenage boy must defend himself or his loved ones against a large woman or a well-trained woman. Similarly, when an opponent is a human monster, in other words, very large or very dangerous for other reasons, I see no problem with individuals ganging up on him for self-defense purposes. There are monsters among those of us in the human species, and you should do what it takes to protect yourself and your loved ones. Nature is not, and never has been, fair. A lion is much bigger than a hyena. Hyenas need to gang up on the lion to have a chance at survival. In conclusion, fight only when necessary. Fight to survive, not to punish. Use whatever it takes to survive. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.